You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 8th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author Nelson Dennis, author of The War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony, days after the 100-year celebration of, I guess, when Puerto Ricans got their citizenship, really just more like celebrating 100 years of exploiting Puerto Rico. Many respects, maybe a vision for America. Also on the program today, the country is asking if even Paul Ryan wants to pass this so-called repeal and replace Obamacare bill. It's really looking like one of those things where, you know, they have everybody in the firing line shoot, some with blanks, some with bullets, so you don't know who to blame when that person gets killed. Well, in this instance, who will we blame when the Republicans don't kill Obamacare? Meanwhile, WikiLeaks exposes a massive trove of CIA spy tools. Trump's wall for border security gonna be paid for by Mexico? No. Going to be paid for by cuts from other security of our borders. Healthcare, schmealthcare. This healthcare bill, it's about tax cuts and lottery winners, ladies and gentlemen.
Got to focus on the lottery winner.
It is International Women's Day, and strikes occurring across the country. The EPA Science Office revamps their mission statement to exclude science. And Clinton's ads, it appears, after research, were policy-free. An ongoing problem, the Democratic resistance to Donald Trump. Frankly, the predictable ongoing problem to the resistance to Donald Trump. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, we got a little bit of counter programming. You know, this is something that I have struggled with in the Trump era. We could avoid having a guest every day. Or we could simply have on reporters to talk about the various aspects of this administration. I haven't even talked about, you know, whatever the latest Russia intrigue is. But we want to continue to maintain the integrity of this show, and by that I mean the integrity to its original format, which is to bring important stories that aren't necessarily tied to the news of the day, maybe to the week or the month of the year. And so we will obviously, and I know yesterday Michael spoke to Michael Schur about the affordable, the American health, whatever that garbage is that they call that tax cut, basically. And we're going to cover that on a more going forward, although I am of the mind that there was never, ever a plan on behalf of the Republicans to pass this legislation. I think this legislation was designed to have so many poison pills in it that it was to never pass. And David Dayan has a piece up basically predicting that this will not pass, and that what's going to happen is going forward, you're just going to have the Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price, use his ability as HHS Secretary to change rules which continue to degrade the Affordable Care Act, at least in the context of the individual markets, and punt. It's a punt. It's a huge punt. And the real question is going to be, will Republicans pay a price for it? But the danger is that Democrats are simply standing back and asking that question and then doing nothing else. And that's a real problem, because there's no proactive agenda that's being put out there. And that's not enough. And it's not enough, as the Clinton campaign showed us, it's not enough to remind everybody that Donald Trump is a horrible human being. I mean, I've been complaining for now, first with the Clinton campaign and now with the Democrats at large, they are not taking the fight to Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. And it's scary. It's just going to mean there's got to be more outside organizing. And, you know, polling has been released that shows that Donald Trump is at a historic unfavorables. The Republican Party also, maybe not historic, but significant unfavorables. The Democrats, even more unfavorable.
People don't like Democrats.
And they have to go out there and do something, I think, more proactive. There's going to be a lot of opportunity, I think, for primaries in this environment for Democrats. And so hopefully we're going to see a lot of outside organizing to primary a lot of these Democrats. I mean, this is the environment for it. And hopefully the threat of that will push them forward. I mean, here is, let's just play one clip. And I enjoyed this clip because the moment the Republicans released their plan, I tweeted out something to the effect of how many pages are in it, because that's the only metric that is meaningful. And it, of course, it was a joke. It was a joke based upon my experience going down to that 928 or whatever it was years ago, a Tea Party Glenn Beck rally in Washington, D.C., and I interviewed probably about 60 people there. Two-way person, they all complained about the size of the Affordable Care Act bill, that it was just so big, and they all, many of them wanted to make the bills less than 10 pages long as a rule or law. Some maybe said, well, there could be, you know, exceptions. And so I tweeted out that joke. And even in my wildest joke dreams, did I conceive of this moment.
Look at the size. This is the Democrats. This is us. There is, I mean, you can't get any clearer in terms of this is government, this is not. And I think that part of the reason the visual is important is that when you actually look at the difference, you realize this is what big government does.
It makes stacks of papers that are 7 times larger than other stacks of papers.
Don't you think, actually, ironically, when you watch Sean Spicer, doesn't your inner Republican get kicked on? You're like, are my tax dollars actually going to fund this guy? This moron on TV with stacks of paper?
The awesome part was there was a moment. We should go back to it in a second, because there was a moment in the middle where he was sort of like his physicality, where he was trying to show that there was a real sort of like, remember that British guy with the funny sweaters who's always like, this machine will juice for you and you will feel healthy and vibrant, right around there, like where he's not sure if he should leave the podium.
The Democrats, yeah. This is us. There is,
right, I mean, there, that
you
part.
You can't get any clearer in terms of this is government, this is not. And I think that part of the reason.
And believe me, when you bring this home, you're going to find that washing the floor is done like in a snap.
You're going to find that this is government and this is not government.
And the fact that that small stack of pages, apparently 66 pages, 6 of those pages dedicated to making sure that lottery winners do not stay on Medicaid. We'll get to that later. But I think this type of theater is really the only reason why they came out with this bill. It's going to die, and then they're just going to hope that their voters forget about it. And you know what? I think their voters will. I don't think they cared about policy ever. Maybe they'll just do a resolution. We're not going to call it Obamacare anymore. We're going to call it the American Health Care Act.
I haven't seen a clip for it yet, but Kellyanne Conway this morning said Trump wasn't like, hey, I want my name on this thing.
Right.
I want it de-blacked.
Yeah.
I want it de-blacked.
There you go.
Sick.
White health care.
White care.
That's what we're going to call it. We're just going to call it white health care.
Maybe Trump care actually is better than white care. It's just a thought.
Let's see how it does. If it wins, Trump care. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nelson Dennis on the 100 years of American citizenship Puerto Ricans have, I guess, enjoyed would be a little bit more than appropriate, or I should say accurate. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Nelson Dennis. He's the author of War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony. And he has written a piece in The Nation magazine, after a century of American citizenship, Puerto Ricans have little to show for it, indeed. So it was 100 years ago, just about 4 days ago, Dennis, that 1 million Puerto Ricans were granted United States citizenship.
Yeah, about a little over, about 1 point, well, about 1.5 million. And it was very timely because it was on March 2nd, 1917, and then Woodrow Wilson sent his declaration of war to Congress exactly a month later. And close to 20,000 Puerto Ricans were then drafted into the war just a month later.
And I mean, how much of the incentive to grant citizenship to Puerto Ricans was that part of it? Was that simply a coincidence, or was that more about the timing than the actual move?
Well, you know, I mean, there is that, right? You can also, one can always say, well, you know, just things happen. But if you sort of reverse engineer your way into through what happened later, there's a series of cases, Supreme Court cases called the Insular cases regarding Puerto Rico as an island. The net result of which found that Puerto Rico, under the territorial and supremacy clauses of the United States, that was not entitled to the privileges and immunities of the U.S. Constitution. So therefore, those returning soldiers, the ones that shot and got shot at, the ones that managed to not get killed, when they come back to Puerto Rico, they weren't eligible, for instance, for a minimum wage, because the privileges and immunities of the Constitution did not apply to Puerto Rico as a territory. So then you ask yourself, so then what was this citizenship about? So that's why I'm saying, kind of like reverse engineer, if it was about, in fact, giving, you know, inclusiveness and bringing Puerto Ricans into the American community, then why did you give them a second-class citizenship when they would come back and then during the Great Depression be working for starvation wages? How much of a citizenship?
So just remind people about the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States. I mean, I think people forget because it's sort of, 100 years later, it's really hard to wrap your head around the idea that Puerto Ricans don't vote for the president of the United States, that they are basically, yeah. I mean, they're really, I mean, in this day and age, Puerto Rico is really treated like a colony would be 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
Yeah, and it's actually, it's a matter of black letter law. It's not just sort of like a subjective feeling. It's actually, that's exactly the relationship, because last year on June 9, 2016, under a Supreme Court case called U.S. v. Sanchez Valle, the Supreme Court, the Obama administration argued through its Solicitor General, and the Supreme Court agreed. They reiterated that Puerto Rico, as a territorial possession of the United States, does not have any political and juridical sovereignty whatsoever, and therefore really it remains under the plenary jurisdiction of U.S. Congress. So 100 years later, last year, and I give that date because actually it's pretty significant, on June 9th, the executive branch of the federal government argued to the judicial branch, and the judicial branch agreed, and on that same day, the legislative branch, Congress, passed the PROMESA bill, which created the Financial Control Board. Now, that's another one of those, that sort of celestial alchemy that we can call a coincidence. When all three branches of the federal government agree on the same day that Puerto Rico is its territorial possession. Now, what complicated it, Sam, in the middle of that, the United States was engaged in a Cold War in the 50s, and it could ill afford to have a classic colony and project itself as the leader of the free world vis-a-vis Russia. So it had to resolve that in some way. They created this hybrid relationship called the Commonwealth. In Spanish, it's ELA, Estado Libre Asociado, Freely Associated State, which is kind of a misnomer because Puerto Rico is not free. It's not a state. That doesn't really have the powers of associations. But it worked because it allowed Puerto Rico, the United States, to go to the Decolonization Committee of the UN and say, well, you see, Puerto Rico is not a colony. It's a commonwealth. And they took it off the decolonization list, off the watch list. And so the United States could, you know, project itself again as the leader of the free world. However, that was in 1952 that they created this. all along, people understood that there was basically no change in the relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico, and that was affirmed last year with the Supreme Court case that I told you. I'll give you one example of what this colonial relationship, how it plays out economically. There's a law that's Section 27 of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, which is also known as the Jones Act, under which Puerto Rico is specifically specifically prohibited from engaging in its own international trade relations. And under the Jones Act, only U.S. goods, only U.S. vessels that are owned, operated, and chartered in the U.S. are allowed to come into Puerto Rico and carry goods. Any foreign registry vessels have to pay enormous taxes and fees and quotas, the net result of which is there's a price fixed system for all U.S. goods to come to Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, 80% of the goods consumed in Puerto Rico are from the U.S., and they all cost about 20% more than they otherwise would have because of the price rigging from the Jones Act. And that's costing Puerto Rico about $4 to $5 billion a year. If it weren't for the Jones Act, there would be no debt. We wouldn't have this public debt of Puerto Rico that created the Financial Control Board. That's an example.
Just in terms of the Jones Act.
1920.
Terms of that Jones Act. So give us a sense of just so that people can compare here. In New York, for instance, we obviously have vessels that come from around the world come into New York Harbor and presumably then get offloaded and whatever it is, eat those things or buy those things or whatever it is. And in Puerto Rico, you can't get it directly from where it's being shipped to.
Right. There's two issues in there. You just hit one. That we can eat what's on up here in New York State. We can also negotiate the prices. Puerto Rico is specifically prohibited from negotiating its own prices from what comes off those boats. So what happens with the Jones Act is a foreign registry vessel can come into Puerto Rico, but it has to pay a steep set of taxes, duties, import quotas, the net result of which is that everything that's on that boat, no matter what it is, a car, food, medicine, clothing, ends up costing about 20% more because the cost gets passed on to the consumer. So that's if the foreign registry vessel comes directly to Puerto Rico. It has an option. It can go specifically to Jacksonville, Florida, where the goods get offloaded, the original foreign registry vessel, and reloaded onto a U.S. boat, and that U.S. boat then reroutes back to Puerto Rico. So that's the equivalent of digging a ditch and filling it up again. You have to reroute the boat, take it off one boat, put it on another boat, bring it into Puerto Rico. And again, the net result is that all those goods end up costing roughly about 20% more. What this does for the U.S. is it allows U.S. corporations to slightly underprice. And this is the biggest piece here. They can therefore come slightly under because they know what the what the costs are going to be coming off those foreign registry vessels. So then they can just come in a little bit under. And Puerto Ricans are very price sensitive. The per capita income in Puerto Rico is slightly over $15,000 per capita, which is about half that of Mississippi, the poorest state of the union. So if they can save a little money, they have to. They will. So that's what this price rigging does. It allows, as an example, the same car in Miami costs $6,000 more in San Juan because of this situation.
And let me just be clear here. If that car had come directly from, South Korea, that car would cost $6,100 more. But because it's looped through Jacksonville, Florida, they'll just jack up the price to $6,000, and that's the way they maintain their competitive advantage over the one coming directly from Korea, which would have to pay all these fees.
Yeah, I'm not sure the math that we just used here. Let me just throw in another. Let's say something will cost $100. Some used car will cost $100 from a foreign source, but because they have to put it through all these other machinations, Jacksonville, or coming directly, it ends up costing say $120. So they've added 20% of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So a car that costs $6,000 more it's about 20% of the cost, because the car would cost about, say, $24,000 as opposed to $18,000, whatever that 20% differential is. So it's just any good that would come in, roughly it costs about 20% more if it comes from a foreign source. And the United States just comes slightly under that. They figure out ways to just charge 18%. It's for that reason that there's more Walgreens and Walmarts per square mile in Puerto Rico than anywhere else on the planet. And they're selling goods at these hyperinflated prices. And it is that plus the inability, because they're prohibited from developing their own shipping industry, which is a foundational industry for an island. I mean, you got to import, you got to export. But if you can't control your own shipping industry or negotiate your own trade relations or have any input on the consumer prices, then you're completely a captive economy. So what's happened is since Puerto Rico has been prohibited from developing its own private economy, the public sector has become the largest employer. And that's where we got into this financial mess, because the government basically has been the largest employer in Puerto Rico, and it racked up very large debt over the last 15 years. And that's where Wall Street has been able to take advantage of it.
All right. I want to get into that. And I want to get into what this FCB, which was set up, and you mentioned this Puerto Rican Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act. This FCB is sort of, I'd say it's reminiscent of what we're seeing, let's say, in a state like Michigan with these emergency financial city managers. But it's not like it's displacing a full sovereignty anyways in Puerto Rico, because, as you said, there's a lot of things that are taken off the table. But broadly speaking, let's just use the example that you do here of Charles Herbert Allen, because I think in some ways that his example really is illustrative of not just how the relationship started, but what the relationship has been, right? I mean, we're just like, Puerto Rico is basically just, wealth is just consistently extracted there for the benefit of a rather small group of people in this country.
For people that, I understand this. As a Puerto Rican, this is something that's near and dear to me, because I have family there. I go in and out. I understand fully how it's difficult for people to focus, because this is an island that's basically 1,500 miles away from New York. So it's separated by an ocean, a language, and essentially a century of propaganda. And, you know, and today with the news cycle that we have with this circus in Washington, it's pretty difficult. I understand how are people. We get one hot minute for people to, look at Puerto Rico, and it's basically when there's a financial crisis. Then the media will pay attention, but they'll do it in the broadest terms, and they won't understand the underlying dynamics. So, as an example, Charles Herbert Allen. He was a template. He comes in. He was the first civilian governor of Puerto Rico in 1901. He barely was there for 1 year, and he left, ran up to Wall Street. And he became a vice president of Morgan Guaranty Trust. And he became a treasurer, then president, then chairman of the board of the American Sugar Refining Company, based upon all his contacts in Puerto Rico, because he put about 600 expatriates, U.S. expats, into the Puerto Rican bureaucracy, who gave him all sorts of land concessions, land grants, riparian rights, sole source contracts, railroad easements. They made it very easy for Charles Herbert Allen to create himself a sugar empire. Puerto Rico was first perceived in 1898 for the geopolitical value of being a naval coaling station, because a good outpost in the Caribbean. But people like Charles Herbert Allen thought, hey, holy, we got something else here. We have a tremendous climate, tremendous soil, cheap labor. The hell with that. Let's turn this place into a huge sugar plantation. And that's what they did. By 1930, 80% of the land under cultivation in Puerto Rico was owned by U.S. banking syndicates. You know, so how does that happen? How do people get disappropriated from their land in 30 years? And so it is that radical divestiture that occurred. It's sort of like the Naomi Klein shock doctrine. Things happen really quickly, and an imposing culture comes in and figures out ways of separating people from their land. And once that happened, Puerto Rico has been in a continuing cycle of dependency. and also creating great profit for the United States. I'll give you two examples. One, we just mentioned the Jones Act. Puerto Rico is the fifth largest market for U.S. goods in the whole world. And as I said, more Walmarts and Walgreens than anywhere else. Secondly, it's an enormous tax haven. There's people there like John Paulson who are getting 20-year tax abatement deals. They pay no interest, dividend, or capital gains income, and they own resort complexes. John Paulson owns the AIG building in Hato Rey. He owns 8.5% of Banco Popular, the largest bank in Puerto Rico. And they just come in and they avail themselves of the economy in a privileged way. Meanwhile, Puerto Ricans themselves are being taxed to death to pay for the fact that the government is running out of money. It's officially going to run out of money in about 2 months. Puerto Rico, they were hit with 105 in the year 2013. They raised 105 different taxes were raised in Puerto Rico. The electricity rates per kilowatt hour are three times what we pay here in New York. They pay about 28 cents per kilowatt hour. Water rates have risen by 60%. This is Puerto Rico has been in this position, basically quietly supporting the U.S. economy. But up here, the way the media reported is that, whoa, Puerto Ricans are getting food stamps and they're not paying a federal income tax. They're basically living off of us, which is very much not the case. But that is the narrative, and that's the misinformation that's developed over 100 years. And now this financial control board is not there to reinstate or develop the Puerto Rican economy. It's just basically a collection agency for these hedge funds. What's going to happen is they're going to privatize the infrastructure of Puerto Rico. They're going to do it with highways, prisons, schools, any physical infrastructure. Goldman Sachs has a 50-year lease on PR-22 and PR-5, the two most profitable highways in Puerto Rico. Mm. That's where things are headed. And again, the American public isn't aware of it.
It's basically going to just turn. It's just more wealth extraction, right? I mean, what this guy did, Alan did 100 years ago with sugar. It seems these financiers are now doing with just about every other asset, living assets, people's sort of kinetic activity, driving, anything they do to live, they're going to extract wealth from that. The government itself of Puerto Rico will get nothing. I mean, you know, you read this stuff and like you say, we never hear about it in our media. And if you're not, I think if you have no direct ties to Puerto Rico, it's just not something that comes up in the course of.
That's a real problem.
We certainly
I keep
don't
saying
get,
that. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in Puerto Rico never happens at all. And you know that's very suitable to any sort of the neoliberal interests that are finding ways of getting their hooks into Puerto Rico, because then they can completely control the narrative up here in the United States.
And so, I mean, how does this end? I mean, where are we since this? Just tell us how the debt crisis supposedly was resolved, I guess. It's just that it's now basically been a big sell-off.
Yeah, you know, you said it really well, Sam. I'll fill in, but you just hit it. The way it developed is that yet another one of these corporate tax schemes that kept Puerto Rico afloat because it has a synthetic economy that is not its own, because it's been made dependent on foreign capital. There was something called IRS 936. It was an IRS code that gave tax preferences to large, especially high-tech corporations such as pharmaceuticals, and it worked. Puerto Rico until 2006 was producing 25% of the world's pharmaceuticals. That stuff that we see on TV, you know, with all the, you know, the 28 side effects. Mm. Well, 25% was coming from, roughly was coming from Puerto Rico, and 90% of U.S. and Canadian pharmaceutical consumption was being produced out of Puerto Rico. In fact, one factory in the town of Barceloneta was producing all of the legal Viagra consumed in the United States. So Puerto Ricans are certainly capable of producing a great deal of joy for their northern neighbors. That was until 2006, which is when the IRS, the 936, lapsed. And so suddenly there was a big financial hole because the pharmaceuticals and the ancillary industries employed about 100,000 people in Puerto Rico. So now all of a sudden there's this big financial hole, and it coincided with the subprime mortgage meltdown in 2007. So this is where, if you're familiar with the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman,
yes,
John Perkins, so this is where the hitman started to come in, because they went to Puerto Rico and they said, you know, you guys have a big gap here, but we have these really good credit instruments. They're triple tax exempt, so they'll be very popular on Wall Street, and we can just do a series of municipal bond financings and keep you guys going. What they did is, what that was injecting Puerto Rico with layers of debt. Layer upon layer. Some of it was so naked that PREPA, the Puerto Rico Electrical and Power Authority, had a series of double A bonds that were issued between 2009 and 2013. And there's a study that, and I think I linked it in the article in the Nation. There's a hyperlink. 82% of those bonds were not paying for electricity, operating or maintenance costs, or even for the payment on principal of antecedent debt. They were paying off the interest on the prior. So that was basically a Ponzi scheme. God, how did we don't get the Justice Department? How this isn't white collar crime? I don't know. But that now PREPA owes $4 billion with compounded interest just from those loans alone.
Let me just ask you this.
This is what started happening in 2006. The debt started to come in.
When they are servicing their debt, where they're going out and getting new loans to service just the interest on loans, like, is it the guy who purchases, you know, those or I guess takes those loans in the Puerto Rican government or in that utility? Is it just simply because they have no other options? I mean, are they aware of the hole that they're being dug, or is just that they're the sense of, I mean, does that guy end up working on Wall Street 3 years later?
Hey, you know, I'm going to give you a great one. There's a guy named Luis Fortuño, who is the prior governor of Puerto Rico. And this is where things get a little gnarly, Sam, because there's a lot of blame to go around. There's people in Puerto Rico, in the government, that basically collaborate and they conspire with this. Luis Fortuño was a governor before Alejandro García Padilla, who just went out. He was only in one term, 4 years, from 2009 to 2013, and he issued more debt than any governor in Puerto Rican history. It was $16.4 billion during the four years alone. $9 billion of which is not fully accounted for yet. $1 billion was for a line item called public relations. You know, wrap your mind on that. Public relations, $1 billion. He had a $400 million gasoducto that never got built. $100 million for a Fideicomiso de Ciencias, which is a science commission, research and development outfit that never developed. And $100 million went missing. So now this guy, Luis Fortuño, while he was in office, his government also spent $23 million on legal fees to Steptoe and Johnson in Washington. Well, Luis Fortuño is now a partner in Johnson. So, you know, I mean, the argument can be made that the guy basically subsidized his own partnership at Steptoe and Johnson with the $23 million tax dollars from Puerto Rico.
Prepaid his own salary.
And he created the Public-Private Authority Commission, which is and started the template of what's called P3s, public-private partnerships, but I call them P5s, public-private partnerships for the plunder of Puerto Rico. Because what the FCB, the control board, is going to do is when these debts become fully due and the government can't pay them, because really Puerto Rico is cash-strapped. In about two or three, it already missed a $312 million bond payment on February 1st. And it's going to continue to default. So when this happens, the creditors are logically going to say, okay, well, if we lend money to PREPA, for instance, the electrical, then, and you guys can't pay, well, we're going to create a public-private partnership, and now we'll step in and we'll act as the controlling authority. And that's what's going to, these debts are going to be converted into P3s all over the island. And unless something, some radical, there's a paradigm shift over the next 5-10 years, what's going to happen, this financial control board is simply going to leave a whole network of P3s that are going to be crisscrossing the entire island that will have essentially mortgaged and privatized the entire public infrastructure of Puerto Rico. They've already sold 300 public schools in the last 2 months. That's been ordered by executive order. And they've just cut 350 school public schools. And they just issued a $300 million budget cut to the University of Puerto Rico. This is probably antecedent to declaring all those sectors as public-private partnerships.
Right.
Exactly. And so that's where, you know, things are just...
So this is basically... Let me just in the context of, let's say, just the Sopranos, right? The IRS code changes. Puerto Rico is, because of all the systemic and structural reasons why they can't basically generate money on that island, having to do with their inability to have ships come in from foreign ports, just unbelievable. So they're short on cash. They're basically forced to go to a loan shark. The loan sharks come in. They load up on the debt, and they know ultimately these guys can't pay. So it's instead of we're going to break your kneecaps, what we're going to do is we're going to take anything on your island that makes you money, and it's going to be half ours. And that's basically it.
Sam, unfortunately, the way you think is very clear, and I think you said it better than I did. You said it very, very clearly. And to give you a sense of the intent behind it, Senator Jim Young, the chairman of the House Committee on Natural Resources that wrote the PROMESA bill, which is actually Orwellian, because PROMESA means promise in Puerto Rico. When they were drafting that bill, congressman suggested an amendment to the Jones Act to exempt Puerto Rico from the Jones Act as a way of saying, you know what, if we're trying to, you know, lift Puerto Rico out of this mess and make it really capable of having a self-sustaining economy so that we're not in this boat 20 years from now, let's deal with the Jones Act. And what Jim Young said is, no, that is non-germane. Those were his words. That is non-germane to this bill. With that, he made it very clear. So the control board is basically all about collecting money from Puerto Rico and converting and creating these P3s, but it's not help about developing the economy in any meaningful way. It was deemed non-germane. They didn't even discuss it. So you're right, Sam. You got it right.
Nelson, let me ask you this, all right? President Obama commuted the sentence of Oscar Lopez before he left, President Obama. And I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I was young in the 70s and was not, I think, sort of like fully conscious of the Puerto Rican independence movement and the violence associated with it. I think, you know, largely people, frankly, aren't aware of any of the sort of the type of violence that we had in this country in the 70s and the 80s in terms of like political violence. But when you hear a story like this, it really does make you wonder, you know, how is there not more? I mean, how do we not have a Puerto Rican independence movement that is not more violent at this point? I mean, because there doesn't seem to be, you know, again, we had a brief moment, I don't know, it was around the time that we had you on the program, I guess maybe 6 to 8 months ago, maybe it was a year ago, I can't even remember now because of this election, but where people contemplate Puerto Rico, but it's usually just because it's going to make a huge financial story and, it, you know, nobody's quite clear on how it resolved. I mean, I think you could sit every news anchor of every major television program, and I would imagine, like, none of them are really quite clear on how it was resolved because it's just not in the news. I mean, how does this measure of frustration and deprivation not lead to some type of, like, blowback?
Yeah, and actually, you opened up a few doors in that. One is which the president and a very iconic figure, and I wrote a lot about him in my book, was Pedro Albizu Campos, who was a president of the Nationalist Party. And one of his adages was, the only time the United States is aware of us is when we become a problem. And that's what happened last year, when it became clear that there was exposure in the municipal bond market. The exposure was big because, very quickly, the municipal bond market is $3.7 trillion a year. The American economy, the gross national product, is about $17 trillion a year. So you divide 3.7 to 17, that's about 20 to 22%. So in any given year, about 20 to 22% of the American economy is being filtered through these municipal bond instruments. If Puerto Rico had been allowed to, given Chapter 9 bankruptcy powers, and renegotiate its debt, then all 50 states would have suddenly said, hey, wait a minute, right, we wanted to go and read our debt portfolio too. So you see, Puerto Rico, in a sense, was staring down up the rifle barrel of the entire capitalist system. And frankly, there was no way that they were going to extend any bankruptcy relief to Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico is really on its own. It has to issue triple tax-exempt bonds with an incredible upside, but it can't protect itself on the downside. Now, what the violent response is a kind of a recognition that you really can't militarily defeat the United States. Right? When push comes to shove, you can try, but you've had FBI infiltration in Puerto Rico. Right. You had a carpeta system that created over 100,000 secret, undisclosed FBI files on Puerto Ricans for a period of 5 decades. There was a law, La Ley 53, it was called La Ley de la Mordaza, a muzzle law, issued in 1948. By the way, the same year that George Orwell published in 1984. Well, Orwell was alive and well in 1948, because under that law, you couldn't say a word, sing a song, whistle a tune against the United States, or even own a Puerto Rican flag, because it was a felony punishable by 10 years. Mm. So under those circumstances, and there was a massacre, by the way, a Ponce massacre, where they killed 19 people in broad daylight on Palm Sunday. We have a population that's been, you know, very strongly been kept in place. Its leaders, its patriots were jailed, and some of them were tortured in prison. And then there's also, Sam, there's this kind of paradoxical escape hatch. Since Puerto Ricans are citizens, one thing they can do is vote with their feet. And that's part of what's happened over the last 15 years. When their backs are against the wall and they just can't make it, the explosion sometimes doesn't happen because they just moved to Orlando. There's right. now 800,000 Puerto Ricans living in Orlando. So, there, you know, there's all these factors that have made it difficult. It's sort of, in a sense, it's been almost subliminal. You know, Puerto Ricans, it's kind of a little bit like a frog. And I said, you know how you supposedly a frog, you put him in warm water.
Right.
And since he's cold-blooded, you raise the heat slowly. I think that's part of what's been happening here. And I think this coming year, though, with the Financial Control Board, there's going to be a sort of a quantum leap in the kind of austerity measures. Mm. And I think that we may, this year, this coming 1 or 2 years, may be a time when there's going to be some drastic things happening in Puerto Rico.
So, and is there, I mean, what can mainland Americans do? I mean, other than, I guess, look for a candidate who is talking about it. I mean, Bernie Sanders probably spoke more about Puerto Rico than any presidential candidate since probably Carter, I would imagine.
I would think, you know, John McCain in Arizona has repeatedly submitted a Jones Act reform bill, which it would include Puerto Rico. So I think one thing that, you know, you do what's possible, you know, you don't sort of shoot for the moon. And statehood that's a whole other discussion, Sam. You know, it'll take like 15 minutes, but I don't think that would happen anytime soon. The United States, I don't think the Congress, a Republican Congress, won't go for it.
Right.
But the Jones Act, that reform is there. It's on the table, and it would even benefit the American taxpayer. The average Joe who's paying these taxes, some of which are going into Puerto Rico, because the only people benefiting from this Jones Act are a very thin slice of corporate executives.
Right. Those are the loan sharks, essentially, who are going in and preying off of Puerto Rico's inability to raise its own funds. And so, you know, you got a vulnerable mark there, and you could charge them, you know, whatever it is, the functional equivalent of 50% interest. And you don't want that guy to be, to have a job that's going to allow him to pay you back and to move forward. Well,
Sam, I could talk about tax code revisions and environmental measures in Puerto Rico and many other things. But you can understand that we need to keep KISS. We need to keep this simple, because the American public, it's, in all fairness, they have too many things. So I would say just focus on this one thing, the Jones Act, over and over, and that would have a massive significance in Puerto Rico.
Nelson Dennis, the book is War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony, and we will link to your piece in The Nation magazine. After a century of American citizenship, Puerto Ricans have little to show for it, I'll say. Nelson, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, wherein we will talk about, finally, those lottery winners. God, they've been getting away with murder,
they're like
ladies
Puerto
and
Ricans.
Gentlemen.
They're just off of the largesse.
It's unbelievable. Finally, in the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Affordable Care Act, how much lottery reform was involved in that? Zero.
How obscene... I mean, I don't know. I was just flashing back during that interview to the news coverage in 2016 in Puerto Rico, and it just made my blood boil all over again. So, I mean, it really was covered like, oh, look at this profligate little island. I guess we'll go in there and whip them into shape.
Right.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, no, it's nice. They're there for, it's basically just a pool of money that only a narrow group of people in this country have access to, and they're going to make sure that they can maintain that access by keeping it's like it's like one of those scenarios where it's like you've got a slave that you don't want to feed too much because you don't want them strong enough to run away, but you need to feed them enough so that they can do work for you.
The Pharaoh created the slavery diet. And it was the perfect diet that allowed Abraham to deliver the message from the Pharisees. So Puerto Ricans are thinking to themselves, in 3,000 years when there's a moon colony, they're going to be in a great position for that. I think we need to think a little bit more positively.
Actually, you know what it is? It's like The Expanse.
It's like The Expanse.
I'm watching that show on Sci-Fi, and it is, now that I mentioned, maybe that's where I got that idea from.
Did you know that the
Expanse,
human brain,
the Belters,
if we drilled a hole in the back of your skull stem, Sam, you would be able to write that show before you even saw it.
We will talk about the affordable American healthcare, or whatever they're calling this, Trump care. I don't even think I think they were like, you know what, just put any name on there because we're not going to pass this. This is just going to be the way that everybody can blame everybody else. And if everybody's to blame, then nobody's to blame.
It's your fault, Bill, of 2017.
Right. I just call it the CYA.
You guys just didn't get it together. It's pathetic.
But the only fly in that ointment is going to be Trump, I think, at some level, because I don't think he gets any of it. And I think he's just going out there saying, like, well, we're going to do this. And I've seen reports that, like, the Koch brothers and Club for Growth and all of these organizations are supposedly livid. We need to get rid of this. And I just think that I don't buy it. I think they are like, whatever. The bottom line is, we want the tax cuts. We want the tax cuts. So if you need to do the, you know, and that's what this bill, of course, does. Well, like I said, we'll talk more about it in the fun half. But that's what this bill does. I mean, there are taxes imposed. And one of the things that, look, the Affordable Care Act was a couple of things. It was not necessarily a way to get health insurance cheaper for everyone. It got it cheaper for some people. Generally, people who were poorer or sicker got cheaper health insurance than they would have in the absence of the Affordable Care Act. For people who are not, and I'm talking about people in the individual marketplace, people who are younger and healthier, they may have paid a little more. But primarily, the Affordable Care Act was a patient's bill of rights, saying that insurance has to actually do what most of us conceive insurance does. Like cover us if we're hit by a bus, cover us if we have cancer, not kick us off the program because, oh, our cancer treatments cost too much this year, you're done. So it was a patient's bill of rights. And then the other part of it was basically a massive redistribution program, like all of our government is in many respects. And sometimes we redistribute the wealth upwards, and sometimes we distribute it downwards on the income and wealth scale. And in this instance, there were taxes imposed upon people who were making more than $250,000 as a couple, more than $200,000 as an individual. There was taxes on capital gains, taxes that was increased as well, 1 or 2 percentage points, to pay for the expansion of Medicaid. They want that money back. And this bill, 1/3 of the savings of this bill, and by savings, I mean tax cuts, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
they're not exactly
savings. It's not exactly savings. It's tax cuts. Will go to I don't know, 3%, 2% of taxpayers.
Yeah, I think it's even lower than 3%.
Maybe it's
these
it's
people 1%. Are like up at night, like the change in my couch might go to give a kid medicine. I can't take it.
Absolutely.
And they're sociopaths.
And so even if this bill fails, they will get that money. They will figure out another way. Maybe it'll be the next one. They'll get it back somewhere else. But I just don't see how this bill is going to get passed. No one seems to like it except for Sean Spicer. And I think that's because he has back problems.
Look so at light. The pages. This one's big. This one's small. I honestly think Katrina Pearson would be way better than Sean Spicer.
Well, it's not.
It's total racism that she doesn't have a job.
We still have time.
Well, apparently she's been rebuffed.
We'll also talk about this WikiLeaks. I'll be honest with you. I just don't. Outside of the top line, which is that there were something like 8,800 documents and files that supposedly came from the CIA's Center for Cyber Intelligence. And apparently they have more. Basically outlines how the CIA has been cracking, getting into your phone and even your smart TV's system before anything gets encrypted. So it's not even like breaking something like Signal. It's just that it's there before it gets to Signal as you text. And I don't know, supposedly this stuff was floating around in certain circles out there that were not the CIA, which is also sort of rather disturbing.
Privatized intelligence?
Privatized intelligence, or maybe they're just, you know, they give it to contractors and somebody's like, hey, Bill, check this out. We can, you know that, you know how you always wanted money to start that, organic mushroom farm that you wanted to build. I just figure out how we can do that.
That's so benign. Contractors just want to get off the grid, man.
I just want some FU money to go out and make that farm in Vermont that I've always wanted.
Or do you remember the story? I said it like right at the beginning. I said that one of the most sort of like disturbing immediate effects of these programs, like with the NSA surveillance, was the amount of that people are going to use this to stalk people. And then it came out I was just, that was another thought that I had.
We'll also talk about the problem that we have that was indicative in Hillary Clinton's campaign, and now we seem to have we have scientific proof of an assessment that I kept making over and over again and would occasionally get pushback on, which is that Hillary Clinton was not running on issues. And even in the primary, she tried to not to run on issues. She was trying to run on her CV. And then by the time, and this was, you know, well, let's go into the fun.
It's now. My turn, you old Jew.
But I as I'm saying this now, I distinctly remember saying 2 years ago in the summer of 2015, not quite 2 years, but pretty close, there's going to be a problem with her running on her CV, particularly if it's Donald Trump, because you can't play on that. You can't play on personalities. You got to play on the field of policies. And they didn't want to do that.
You
and I don't know if it was just
have,
incompetence or... No, look.
A winning personality to play.
Well, I know. Well, that
that's
aside,
another factor.
Yes, but yes, that's true. But you can see what happens when you get a president with a winning personality, but again, not playing with no policies.
Right.
You get a Barack Obama and you leave a decimated Democratic Party.
That's true, though I think in 2012, just strategically, they actually fused personality with a very specific policy critique, which they didn't follow through on, but it was constantly about outsourcing, income inequality. So, you know, they actually
fused it.
There
was going to be a mortgage. We're going to have a special mortgage committee.
There's going to be a mortgage committee. Believe me, it's going to be great. I found out that George W. Bush hacked me. Sick!
All right, we're going to take a break. Folks, just a reminder. My friend yesterday told me, like, you got to say that at the beginning of the show. You always ask for people to become members at the end of the show. You got to do it at the beginning of the show. But my theory was, yes, but... if you're listening to the end of the show, you'd be more apt to want more material.
You're already convinced.
And so if you're listening to the sound of my voice, for gosh sakes, and you have the financial means to become a member, why not become a member? You know you want maybe the option on some day of listening. I mean, we just did an hour free for you. Usually it should be 45 minutes.
When you see the Jew coming, you must be careful of his teeth.
The point being... become a member today, just pennies a day.
You must grab it by his money.
Pennies a day, folks. Become a member. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. If you buy crap from Jet or Amazon, do it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Quick break. We'll be right back after this. Oh, don't forget, April 8th, live. At the Bell House.
The Bell House. The Bell Hi, House. Everyone.
I couldn't remember it.
I don't remember too good.
The Bell House, live with Janine Garofalo, Matt Taibbi. We'll be right back after this.